from the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida. It's the Annie Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's July 22nd, 2011, and you're listening to the best poker cast in the world. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We had a nice little home game this weekend.
Always nice when we have the home game because we just don't have it often enough.
Yeah, it's a shame. We used to play like two or three times a month. Now it's like we're lucky if we get one in a quarter.
Yeah, it's real frustrating.
And but, it's always fun when we get together too. You know, it's always a good time and just we're just so busy. You know?
And, you know, if we get more hands like we had in this one, I don't know if that means that we'll have more home games or people will just get ticked off and leave.
I know. I wonder. I do. I wonder if our games were this contested, you know, I wonder if they'd actually would cease to exist. This was a PLO hand.
Absolutely amazing hand.
And it's funny because, you know, when you always know what Gambit is going to call. In our game, when it gets to him, he's either calling PLO or Badoogie. And then occasionally he'll call just Omaha 8. But yeah. It's pretty much PLO or Badoogie when it gets to him. So, sure enough, he was down a little bit. And he gets to him and he calls PLO. And I'm like, all right, you know, got to start thinking about how to play the game and you know, the strategic things to it and everything. And one of the things I noticed was Faso was down. A decent amount. I think maybe he had like 50 or 60 left in front of him or so. At that point, I think I was up about 25, and I think Gambit was down a little too. I think he might have been maybe down to like 80 or so, maybe even less. I'm not really sure, but it was around that. Those are the effective starting stacks, as Scott would say, so that if I'm wrong, it doesn't matter. You can't crucify me.
Drink it out of jail free card. We use it liberally on this show.
Scott, you were right on my right in the small blind. I was in the big blind. Pat was in the game this week, and he was on my left. Gambit was after him in the cutoff, and Faso was on the button. And when we play, you know, we don't play huge stakes. We play 25-cent PLO.
Yeah.
And I think at this point, we had one limper when it got to Gambit, and then he limped. And then Faso raised... I believe it was a dollar. I think it was. I think you folded. And I had some sort of rags that were kind of connected. It was like seven of hearts, eight of hearts, two of diamonds, and five of diamonds, I'm pretty sure. I'm sure it was two hearts and two diamonds, and I had seven, eight, deuce. I knew there was a seven and a deuce in there, and the other cards worked with it. But so I reluctantly called a raise. I figured, you know what, Faso's raising here. He's probably got something like pocket aces. I was pretty convinced. So I figured if I flopped two pair or something, or if I flopped a really big draw and he got it in, I might be able to bust him and have a nice day. So that was my thinking behind calling with 7-8-5 deuce double suited. I think Pat called. I know Gambit called. So there was at least $5 in the pot. And the flop came jack of hearts, two of hearts, six of diamonds. And it might have been the eight of diamonds, I think, because I think I flopped two pair. That's what it was, eight of diamonds. So we're at jack of hearts, two of hearts, eight of diamonds. So I have two pair and a backup flush draw. And I'm thinking that everyone will check to Faso because he raised preflop. And then when it gets to me, I'll be first to act after he raises, or bets, I mean. And then I could check raise his inevitable C bet. So I do, I check. And then Pat checks, but it gets to Gambit and he bets pot, $5. So I was like, all right, well, we'll see what happens here. And then it gets to Faso, and Faso min raises to 10. So then I'm like, oh, my God, now I go into the tank, and I'm thinking, am I up against a set of jacks and, like, the nut flush draw, thinking Faso has, you know, either the set of jacks or the nut flush draw, and then, you know, Gambit has the other hand that makes sense. So I really thought a while. It's probably the longest I thought about a hand all day. And ultimately I folded, and I handed you the cards. And I'm like, you know, well, look at these. What do you think? You know, and then you had, I thought for sure you were going to give me the, oh, yeah, fold that. And then you didn't. You kind of gave me this sort of, eh, I don't know. And I'm like, damn, what? Are you saying I should have called $10? Because then I had no idea what Gambit was going to do.
Yeah, so my thinking when I first looked at your cards is that you had just so many outs. But then when you think about it a little harder, you realize you have very little outs and maybe no outs.
Yeah, I could have no outs.
just know. Depending on, you know, what you're putting your opponents on. So, you know, if somebody's got a set of jacks, that kills a lot of your outs. And if somebody has a higher flush draw, that kills some other outs. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Really, your hand looks a lot better than it really is, if that's the case. If,
yeah.
You never know. But.
And then I'm thinking, you know, runner-runner eights, runner-runner deuces. You know, I mean, that's the only way I could win if I'm up against a set and I'm not flush draw. So I ultimately let it go, and it's a shame because if Gambit doesn't bet, I think that I get Gambit out, but we'll hear about the rest of the hand first. But anyway, so, okay, I do fold. Ultimately, I fold. Pat folds. Then Gambit re-pops it, and that's when I take my hand and put it on my shoulder and pat myself saying, all right, I was right, because I know that one of those guys has me.
Didn't want to get into that.
Yeah. So he re-pops it, and at that point, it's a ton of money. I think he even bets pot, so it's like a $50 bet or whatever, and Faso will have about $20 left if he just calls, and he knows he can't just call now. Either he's going to shove or fold. And he ends up shoving for another like $23, I think it was. And, you know, Mark's all, you could tell Mark's like, oh man, you know, I'm hoping that I'm good. So he calls, and no one shows their cards, which is kind of weird. Usually in our game, you know, it's not like it's the casino where everybody wants to bust each other's balls or slow roll them or something. Usually we just show the hands, and they didn't. Neither guy showed. And the board goes, queen of clubs on the turn, queen of hearts on the river. And Faso just kind of shrugs and kind of reaches into his wallet thinking he's going to, you know, rebuy. Turns over his two aces, and that was all he had were bare aces, and now he has aces and queens. And Gambit just, like, blew his top. The running queens screwed his two pair. I think he had jacks and eights. And he was fuming. I mean, he was just sick because he couldn't believe that someone could call there with just naked aces.
Right.
And then what made me sick was I would have made my flush and they didn't have a flush.
Yeah.
And I would have won like this, you know, $200 pot or something. And I was just sick for it. And then Faso goes from, you know, a pretty decent loser to posting a profit for the day. And I'm just curious. I mean, how does he make that call there? How does he min raises too, which is not really good in Omaha because everyone's drawing. So you're giving him the right odds to just call anyway. I couldn't believe it. I didn't. Not that he's not here to defend himself, but could you have made that call or that shove?
No. I was fairly shocked when they turned it over. So yeah, I mean, it's easy for us to say no, couldn't do it. I mean, obviously at the end, I think you're right. He got kind of caught himself pot committed.
Yeah.
And either he needed to fold or shove, and you know, it's tough because Gambit's a really good PLO player.
Yeah.
And like most good PLO players, he doesn't always play premium stuff.
Yeah.
You know, he likes to put pressure on people in right spots. So, you know, if you're looking at just the hand on paper without any names attached to it, it's really easy to put him on a set of jacks or something that has you killed. But when you know the player a little bit, it's really hard to figure out exactly where he was.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, do you want to throw that away on someone that's bluffing or not? I mean, but really at the end, I mean, just you're right, just bare naked aces is all it was.
Unbelievable.
And that's tough to take that kind of chance, hoping that your opponent's bluffing or... in this case, it wasn't really bluffing. He just didn't have as strong of a hand as probably people gave him credit for.
But, I mean, he had top two, and he's probably trying to force out draws too on top of it, which worked.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, if I was up a bunch of money, I mean, I'm re-popping it again and getting Gambit out of there because Gambit can't bluff now. He'll know what he thinks his two pair are good. He's a good enough player to fold that. So. I just didn't have enough. I just thought, you know, I only have $100 in front of me here. If I'm popping it here, it's going to cost me a whole stack on baby pair, and I may be behind. So I didn't. But if I had a bunch of money in front of me, I probably would have speculated and called the 10 and seen what happened or re-raised again. So, yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was really convinced that Faso had, like, aces with the nut flush draw, and Mark had – because, you know, Jax isn't really a big hand pre-flop, so that's why he wouldn't have raised with him.
Right. Yeah.
So I really thought he had set of jacks, and Faso had the ace of hearts in his hand, nut flush draw, with pair of aces. And I thought, I'm just dead to no matter what happens, so that's why I laid it down. And I just couldn't believe it. It was like the hand of the week, really, for us. I mean, it was a huge pot, and to show the winning hands, the queen-queen really killed him. I mean, that's like 700-1 or something for it to come queen-queen like that on him to make him lose or, you know, some weird odd. But
yeah, well, the all the ways to lose that hand.
Yeah, exactly. So I felt bad. But, you know, one of the things, too, is we started playing some different games lately. Games that, you know, we used to always, you know, kind of be pompous about, hey, we only play games of World Series bracelets, you know, that kind of crap. But we started playing games that aren't necessarily bracelet games anymore, and I'm having kind of fun with them. You know, we had Super Crazy Pineapple this week. Mm-hmm. When Pat said, let's play that. That's you get dealt four cards like Omaha, but you throw one away after the flop and one away after the turn, sure. And just play it like Hold'em. That was kind of fun. Kind of sick, yeah. Really.
I really liked that one, and I think I took to like a fish out of water to that right away, yeah. And understood kind of the advantages of that and the type of hands you can play, knowing that you only have to discard one and then see how the turn develops before you figure out which is the next one to discard. It really makes a big difference.
Yeah.
From Pineapple.
Yep.
So, you know, I think I did really well in that rotation. I'm sure I got a little lucky. But at the same time, I think I was able to play hands knowing that I could go either way on the turn with them.
And you, I mean, I think it was right around that point, too, when you went on your heater. I mean, you were down a whole buy-in, I think, at one point, and then you ended up posting a really nice little profit for yourself. So that really kick-started it for you.
You're right. We always were kind of pompous about wanting to play only games that are dealt in casino. And to be honest, we're still playing games that are just variations of those.
Right.
It's not like we're bringing Follow the Queen in to the game or something crazy like Irish High Low.
Which we'll hear about later today.
but really, I kind of think of it. I mean, it's a slippery slope. I mean, if you do Super Crazy Pineapple, then, you know, what's the next thing that you throw in because, you know, it's just. And then you wake up and you're playing a bunch of weird games. But, you know, for right now, you know, I've always liked playing these games because they test the poker muscles a little bit. And that's exactly what I think the Super Crazy Pineapple did for me.
Yeah, it was really cool.
I mean, you look at it differently.
You always sit there and you think about your strategy before you get into the game. And then and you move on from there and you adjust accordingly how they're playing or whatever. But it was interesting. And then it's like, I forget, now, we also played... Crazy Pineapple High Low.
Yeah.
Where you
probably didn't go over well, shorthanded probably.
Yeah, but. It's tough. And then you know you can actually play your low with one card in your hand and then but if somebody has that same card in their hand and have another low in their hand, and then it's kinda like weird. Yeah, I think a full table would be a much more juicy game, but we only had like four or five hand at that point, so.
Yeah.
And the other thing I'm starting to enjoy is no limit five card stud with the first and last cards down instead of just the first card. I mean, it's not as pure as Cincinnati Kid, but it adds that element at the end where you can bluff or, you know, people won't really give you credit for a hand that you've just made. And it's interesting. I mean, I didn't win a lot playing it, but I just liked it. And I'm starting to appreciate that game more. And it's one less, or actually two less betting rounds, right? Two fewer betting rounds, I guess, than regular stud. But anyway, it's still, some pots can get up there when you're playing that game.
Yeah, I think we've really... tried hard to try to get a five card stud variation going that makes sense, and we've had this ongoing debate over whether the traditional way was an action game or not.
Yeah,
and so I mean, this kind of, you're right, it takes away some of the pureness of it, but it helps with the betting a little bit, I think. And you know, when you're playing, you know, no more than eight handed like we do in our game, you know, you need some games that spur some action.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was cool. I'm starting to appreciate that. But it was nice to get together again and play, and hopefully, you know, someday we'll be able to find time to play more regularly again.
Yeah, because I don't get to play enough, and I got to say, this might be my first winning week ever.
Overall?
Probably not ever, but in a long time, you know, I played the home game, and I rallied from that deep deficit and posted a nice little profit. And then, as tradition, I went to one of the local poker rooms to proof our pages for the magazine this month. And usually what I do, because, you know, we're stuck here in Florida, land of no limit hold'em, is that I end up just getting in a tournament and playing a tournament when I proof, because I would just rather do that than sit there and, you know, lock horns with somebody in a 1-2 no limit game all night. And, of course, you know, tournaments, you're not going to cash often.
Right.
So I usually just call it like $60 tax for the month while I proof pages, and maybe I get like, and I've gotten close. I bubbled so many of them. It's crazy. But so this week I actually ran out of ink in the printer and had to go to the Office Depot and finish them up. So I missed a tournament, went and played 1-2 no limit because I've decided I can't play the 1-1 no limit there anymore.
Okay.
It's really turned into like a 2-4 limit game. You know, there's just not enough money on the table. You know, people are raising to $2, you know, ridiculous stuff like that. And it's just frustrating. So, you know, I'm firmly a 1-2 player there now. And to be honest, this 1-2 now is starting to play a lot like the 1-1.
Oh, man.
So I don't know if the game's changing or I'm changing or both. I certainly don't think I want to jump into a 2-5 next time. But this 1-2 was pretty tame. And, of course, it helped that I flopped a set of kings on the first orbit and had two people all in against me. Was able to survive that nice little infusion of cash and walk away a winner for the night. So my first winning session proving. I'm sure of that.
Wow. Well, I get half of that, right? Don't I get half of that because you won doing an ante-up job while you're...
Yeah, that's a good question. We'll have to look at our contract on that.
Wow, very good.
It also means that you owe me half of all my tournament entries.
That's true. Yeah, never mind. You can keep your 40 bucks. That's clearly a losing deal there for me. Wow. That's cool, though. I mean, you know, and I always wonder, I've never actually seen you doing the proofing, but I can only imagine, you know, what it's like. You have these, like, pages strewn all over the table, or you got them on your lap or on the ground, and you're trying to answer your phone and do the betting. I mean, how can you possibly win doing all that? I don't know how you do it.
I keep them in a notebook, so they're all stacked neatly. So the only frustrating thing is that, you know, I'm proofing, and then when I get dealt cards, I'll look at my cards, and if I'm going to play, then I close up the notebook, put it on the ground, and focus on the hand. And if I'm not, then I just, you know, muck them, obviously. But it is kind of frustrating going back and forth between that. And because I'm proofing on my lap, my feet aren't firmly on the ground.
Yeah.
So it's like I'm a ballerina for 3 hours there. So, yeah, it's not the best thing to do, but you know, it's better than just sitting on the couch doing it.
I wonder what kind of tells you give off.
Yeah.
he folded his, you know, notebook this way, and that means he's got a big hand, or, you know, who knows. I'd like to watch that for a couple minutes. Well, let's get right to the mailbag this week. Brian Smith, he wrote in and said, you know, loosen up for 6 max play, and what does that mean to you?
Yeah. All right, here's what he wrote in. He says he's from near where I went to college, too.
Oh, cool.
Ohio, so very, very cool there. He says he's a lover of the free roll, so we signed up for Hero Poker. Hmm. Yeah, I guess we can we don't have to play this game anymore where we say site's not affiliated with any opera. Though, to be honest, I've never heard of Hero Poker.
Me neither.
All right, so we signed up for Hero Poker, and he says the site offers 2 free rolls per night. One pays out $11 each to the top 9, the other 50, 30, 20 to the top 3. The former runs too early for me, so I play in the latter. It's 6 max and usually gets around 90 combatants. Combatants, I love that.
That's a great word.
And mostly the same folks. It says place tight for a free roll, locally, likely due to the value. You get 3,000 chips, 8-minute levels. After the break, in an hour, blinds are 150, 300, and half the players might still be alive.
Huh.
He says he's won not long ago, but he still wants some advice. He doesn't feel good about how much to open his hand ranges, especially under the gun. He says he normally plays pretty tight, and I get a lot of respect. I feel as if I need to be aggressive since, 1, it's 6 max, 2, plays fairly tight, and 3, only pays at the top 3. He says, but his image does come in pretty handy, especially when cards are cold. He wants to know, Chris, can he now play the Cosenza?
Yes, yes, that is the perfect scenario to play the Cosenza. And you don't even have to be named Cosenza to play it.
Although it helps.
That's Ace-10 for anybody who's just not, you know, just now picking up the show and listening to it. Ace-10 is the Cosenza.
Well, you know, I sent him some advice, I thought, which, you know, again, it's always dangerous when people accept my advice. you know, I told him it's nice to have a tight image and play off of it, but it's hard to be successful in the long run in this particular type of tournament if you're a nit.
Right.
You know, it's 6 max, so, you know, as most people know, you got to take away the first 3-4 positions in a full ring game. So when you're under the gun in the 6 max, you're really actually in middle position.
Right.
You know, so you need to open up your hand ranges to what you'd normally play there. And then, of course, it's always better to play against type, right?
Right.
So, table's loose, tighten up. If it's tight, loosen up. And then when a tournament has a top-heavy payout structure, it's definitely one of those go big or go home things, I think.
Yep. Yeah, you got to loosen up because fourth is not going to get you anything.
Yeah, you have to consider your time, you know, especially if you're passing up other tournaments you could play. So you don't necessarily need to be crazy, but you really do want to build a stack quickly or get eliminated quickly so you can get in another tournament. And then I said, all that being said, it's never a good idea to play the Cosenza.
Yeah, no, I mean, I, to be honest, you know, I don't like the hand. You know, I mean, it just got named after me for some situational thing that happened that was years ago, and people think I like to play it or whatever, but, you know, I really don't. But it can make you Broadway, so hey.
Yeah, that's true.
Can make you Broadway,
true.
And it would be the
can
nuts
also
if you
make
made
you broke.
It. It would be nuts if you made it, though, so.
Well, you know, so I sent that email off, and then he wrote back happy to say that he finished second in the next tournament after beating my advice.
Wow, so, dude, everything you touch turns to gold.
Na-na-na-na doo-doo. I actually know what I'm talking about.
Stick your head in doo-doo.
So, I don't know. Was I off base? Did I miss something?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't like to be tight in a 6 max, though. I mean, if you have a tight image, then you can get away with stuff maybe later on. If you're with them long enough at your table, you know, online it's tough to be with the same 5 players for a while. I think... you know, I like to be loose no matter what when I play, and when it's six handed. I mean, when I play cash games, 5 or 6 handed, you know, when I was playing online, you know, I was crazy. I would just see as many flops as possible and raise with any 2 cards and stuff. But you know, when you're playing with tournaments, and you know, then it might be a different way of playing, and maybe tight is right for you. You know, I don't like to be tight though when I'm playing six handed.
Yeah, I think it really is. It's really, really difficult to be tight 6 max because you're playing so many hands that the blinds start eating you up.
Yep.
And it's really hard to profit off that tight image. I mean, you might get 1 or 2 good opportunities during that tournament, but you might not have the chips at that point to really profit off of them. So, you know, what I think is interesting in our home game, too, is I got this reputation for being extremely loose limit hold'em player.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's because of shorthanded.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, if a lot of the home game players came and watched me playing a full ring game at a real casino, I'd be playing very differently. And that's part of the reason is that, you know, when you're that short, you can't just sit there and wait for aces.
No, absolutely. I mean, you got to think about, you know, when the reason why you can wait for aces in a full ring 10 is because you're getting at least 4 more hands per rotation, and that equates to, like, you know, like 20 hands an hour. Or so. So you've got more hands for the same price of the blinds as, you know, way more hands than you would if you were six-handed. So six-handed, you're getting, you know, 2 or 3 times the amount of hands. So you can't sit there and wait because you're going to keep hitting the blinds that many times faster.
Yeah.
You have to increase the range that you're going to play, and it makes sense. So yeah, no, always adjust to your surroundings and loosen up the fewer players there are.
And I think we're always fond of saying, you know, don't learn how to play poker by watching it on TV.
Yeah.
Because they're contrived situations. But this is one situation where I think you do get a little bit of lesson in how to play, because you know you watch like a World Poker Tour final table, which is 6 max at that point. I mean,
right.
The tournament wasn't. But, you know,
right.
you start to see how the hand ranges change a little bit. And, of course, there's other considerations there. But I think that's one situation where you can watch and see what kind of hands people open with under the gun versus in a real a full ring game.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Brian, we appreciate you sending that mailbag in to podcast@anteupmagazine.com, and we'll be happy to send you a T-shirt from the PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Anteup store at anteupstore.com. And everybody else, send us an email, and you too can win wonderful prizes.
Our hotline is 813-448-1120. If you call that line and we use your clip, we will give you something cool. This call comes from O'Malley.
I'm just listening to an older show of yours about checking in the dark, and I was wondering, I'd like to run a move by you guys to see if you think it's a good move or if it's not. I was in a hand not too long ago where I had pocket aces, raised pre-flop, out of position, and got a call in late position from a guy who likes to, actually, you know what, he was in early position raised, I re-raised and he called. He likes to check dark frequently. When the flop came out, before it came out, he checked dark. And so I bet $300 into about a $400 pot dark. and he ended up folding the hand. So I'm just wondering, it was a check dark and a bet dark. What do you guys think of that?
All right, well, the check dark thing, you know, it's weird because, I mean, I've seen that a lot. You know, he brings it up about checking dark then betting dark because someone checked dark. And I've seen that plenty of times on, you know, some guys, like, even stop the action and say, okay, I bet dark. Will you raise me dark? You know, and I've seen that on TV. And
yeah, yeah.
So it happens all the time. And I think that I have no problem betting dark if someone's checked dark because at that point, if I had been the raiser, I think I have a better hand anyway. Not that I'm going to do it. I really think you lose a lot by doing that. And I think the guys who check dark generally are doing it because they want to act last and they right. want to focus on you reacting to the cards. And, you know, some think it's Bush League and some think it's advanced. I mean, you know, Phil Hellmuth does it and he's got 11 World Series bracelets. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I'm not anywhere near the quality of a Phil Hellmuth, but I can see the reasoning for checking dark if you just have nothing on this person and you want to watch them react to something or whatever. But the bet dark thing, I think it's one step too many. I think that you're taking a chance there of not watching him react, or, you know, you're taking, you know, a chance away from yourself to making the right move. The right move may be to bet more than you did or less than you did or not bet at all, and you've taken that away from yourself. I don't like to hurt myself there. And the same thing with the bet dark. I mean, the check dark. I mean, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're really desperate and you really want to act last and see what this person reacts like when they look at the flop, you know, that's one thing. But taking it to the next step and betting money dark, you know, when you don't know if you have the best hand or not, is tough. It's a tough thing to do. I don't recommend it.
Well, I think this is one of the situations where you have to know your opponent.
Yeah.
If it's somebody, because, you know, again, one of the big reasons you mentioned that you check dark is that you want to, you know, get the chance to act after your opponent has reacted rather than you first. So, you know, you're trying to take away a disadvantage and turn it into an advantage. So by betting dark, you kind of like turn the tables on them and put it right back into their court. Though at a higher stakes, obviously. So, right. You know, if you know your player's doing it just because he wants to see you react first, then that's different. And I think the betting dark will probably be more successful then because you're taking away what he's trying to do. But, you know, that's, I think I've even checked dark when I know I had a pretty big hand.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind giving a free card if they happened to check behind me and wanted them to, you know, take a stab beforehand, thinking that, you know, I exactly the opposite of what we just talked about. So if you do that, then you're putting out money blind, and then you're probably going to get raised and then have to react then, so it's almost like a wasted bet.
Yeah. And, you know, you see a lot of check darks on the river in stud games.
Yeah,
People do that a lot.
Absolutely.
You know, when they're first acting, they just want to check it down or whatever. A lot of people do that. But in Hold'em, and especially no-limit Hold'em, you know, I don't like the betting dark at all. The check dark is, there's some merit to it, I think, but the betting dark after a check dark is pretty ballsy, and I think could hurt your game a lot more than help.
Well, you know, the other thing too, and it's probably not a big deal, but it does make it confusing for the table and the dealer.
Yeah.
You know, the check dark is fairly understood now, but even that sometimes, you know, people don't say it quickly enough or loudly enough, and it gets confusing. And, you know, if the dealer doesn't hear you check dark and the player doesn't hear you check dark and you're trying to check dark, guess what? You just...
you just checked live.
Yeah, you lost the advantage of what you're trying to do. And sometimes that happens. And so then if you have somebody checking dark and then betting dark and the cards are even out there, it gets really confusing, I think, for the dealer. And, you know, I want to have some respect for the dealer that... not that they're not professionals and can't handle all this extra stuff, but it's really unnecessary.
Yeah, it's pretty trivial most of the time anyway.
All right, well, O'Malley, we love that you sent it in, and you're going to love this. You're going to get an uncut sheet of the J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. You can only win the uncut sheets, but you can buy the cards in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com. And our good friend Jason from J-Design, the creator of the cards, has said, uncut sheets for the rest of the year.
Awesome.
For the rest of the year.
Awesome.
So send us in some quality stuff so you get some I mean, this is really a generous offer from him. It's much more expensive, obviously, to send these gorgeous uncut sheets than decks of cards. So send us some good stuff. And, you know, if you liked O'Malley's call there, guess what? We're probably going to hear a little bit more from him on the show in the coming weeks.
Yeah, we're working with him now. He's going to come up with a new segment called O'Malley's Move.
I like it.
And, yeah, we're going to put you in cash game situations and see how you react and see what he should do. And then we'll have it the following week. So we'll sort of start up another little segment for people to react on because everybody likes the analysis and the real hands and things like that. And we're just so busy lately. We haven't been able to get a lot of our own. So we're going to enlist O'Malley to get us some stuff. So we're pretty excited about it. It should start next week.
Excellent. All right, don't forget, I don't know how you could forget our crew. We shamelessly plug it every show. But we're coming down on the actual final booking deadline for the summer cruise, which is August 29th and September 2nd out of Port Canaveral, Florida. Still $369 per person on double occupancy. I think I have three cabins left at that rate. So give me a call or go to anyupmagazine.com/cruise for more information. And we are now taking bookings for our winter cruise. That's out of New Orleans, a 7-nighter, stopping in Mexico, Jamaica, and Grand Cayman. And just added, we're going to have a women's championship on board, sponsored by Lips Tour. That's going to be open to all the women who sail with us, not just the ones that qualify in Lips satellites. So upping the ante to be... cliche.
And that's the winter cruise, right? The Lips Tour is on the winter cruise?
That is on the winter cruise.
Very cool. Hey, you know what else is very cool? Next month we are going to be coast-to-coast, officially coast-to-coast with Annie Up Magazine. We are moving into California, baby. There's gold in them dar hills. And our magazine will officially be distributed and covering the California local poker scene. We just added three ambassadors there.
Mm-hmm.
Very exciting, including podcast listener VB Dave. He's going to be taking care of LA for us.
Yep,
we're very excited about that. And then
because Randy Newman turned us down, I'm really upset about that.
You remember that show? That was a great show, and I had the Randy Newman song playing, and you guys got back from LA. That was a lot of fun. That was a good episode. And also, just to update you a little more, Don Matasovsky. Is that how you say it?
I'm glad you said it.
He's one of our listeners, too, and he's going to be handling Missouri for us, basically the St. Louis scene. But if anything else happens around Missouri and he finds out, he'll let us know. So he's going to be our ambassador for Missouri. And, you know, a lot of the listeners, they really want to get involved and really want to do this because they play a lot in their area, and they like the magazine, they like us, and go figure. And
I think they want a free shirt.
They want the free shirt. So he's going to be handling Missouri, and we got three in California. I tell you, man, it's taking off, baby. We're taking off.
Excellent. And you can join our roster by going to annieupmagazine.com/ambassadors and fill out the application there. We're still looking for about a handful or so.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if you want to do it, we're nice to work for.
Well, I am, at least.
If they don't work for you, they work for me. All right. Let's see what's piling up on the Annie Up news desk this week.
The World Series of Poker has released the schedule for the 8th season of its circuit, featuring 16 events from coast to coast, beginning and ending in Louisiana.
Hmm.
Changes this year include making all stops 12 days long. All events start at $300, and main events will be $1,600 at every stop. And they're eliminating the regional championships this year. Instead, players can win bids to the national championship in a variety of ways, including winning a main event or the casino champions title at any of the stops.
Ah, interesting. I think I heard, too, there are 12 rings in 12 days, they were saying. So
yeah, that's kind of their tagline, too. Yeah. So, I mean, it's on a consistent schedule, which is good because you'll know, you know, when it starts and ends without even looking at the, at least the days of the week, without even looking at the schedule for each. You know, those regional championships, I guess they didn't work out very well. I think those were, what, $10,000 buy-ins this last year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, the economy's hurting, that kind of stuff. So, you know, now you know it's going to be $1,600 for the main event everywhere you go. And, you know, it's a good price point. I mean, that's an easy satellite price point for a lot of people, and easy to buy in for people with decent rolls, too.
Yeah, the first stop is Bossier City, right, in Louisiana?
Yeah, it's a brand new stop. It's going to start September 8th, and then it's going to end at Harrah's, New Orleans, right before the World Series.
I hear they're building like a tent on the roof of the building or something.
It's going to be interesting, I think.
Yeah. Okay, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton signed a budget agreement on Wednesday, ending a government shutdown that idled poker operations at Canterbury Park and Running Aces for 3 weeks.
Yeah, this has been a crazy situation up there, and our ambassador, Poker Geek MN,
yep,
has been all over it, and fighting mad, too.
And he should be, especially because, you know, the Minnesota Racing Commission, is that what it's called? You know, they're basically funding it anyway for these poker rooms to be open, and for them to tell them that they can't keep them open even though it's privately funded anyway, and all of their bills are being paid by some other entity anyway. And they told them they had to shut down. And if they had just said, yeah, you can stay open because of that, they wouldn't have lost a penny. Instead, they lost it was some serious cash a day. Yeah. It was like $100,000 a day or something like that.
Well, they were closed during July 4th, one of the bigger weekends.
Yeah.
And, one of the interesting things in Poker Geek's column and our next issue coming up was the fact that, you lost some live racing days. And just like here in Florida, you have to minimum number of live racing days in order to keep your poker room open.
Yeah.
So now they got to find a way to, meet that requirement. And, when track shut down, horsemen are like, hey, I need to go where I can make some money. This is your problem, not my problem.
Yeah.
And some of them left too. So very interesting that you had two private companies idled by a government shutdown. Real frustrating, as most government always is, and so I know everybody up in Minnesota is happy that it only lasted 3 weeks.
Man, I mean, that's like $2 million right there, of just running costs and stuff, and it's just crazy.
Well, and the real ridiculous thing, not to get too political on this, but these government shutdowns are just crazy. I mean, they're doing it because they don't agree over the budget, which is legitimate. I get that, but when you're closed for 3 weeks, I mean, the amount of money that the state is losing out on,
yeah,
in that 3 weeks certainly goes somewhere towards helping this budget, I think. And the funniest thing, and I think it's an AP story I read yesterday, is that right now they don't know how much the state lost in this 3 weeks because the people that could figure that out were not able to work for the last 3 weeks.
Which came first, chicken or the egg, Scott?
Yeah, and of course, being shut down for 3 weeks, I mean, it's not going to really the poker rooms, I believe, are probably already up and running, I believe. But, a lot of the government agencies, I mean, imagine if you and I took 3 weeks off of work.
Yeah.
And came back. It's not just like business as usual the next day. You got 3 weeks of work to catch up on,
No one was doing your job for 3 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, the repercussions of this are going to last probably months, at least.
Just sick.
All right, finally this week, the poker mockumentary Hitting the Nuts won a Golden Ace Award at the Las Vegas Film Festival. It's the third film festival at which it's been honored. The film is set in Indiana, where townsfolk compete in a regular game in the basement of a funeral parlor.
I'm speechless. I have nothing to say about this.
Now, I can't remember whether we've talked about this before or not, because I know I've heard about it, but I read a little bit more about it, and I tell you, I mean, not just because it's winning the awards, but the concept is really, really pretty funny. It was a kind of a struggling actor in L.A., and he decided to write his own movie, and thought he liked to play poker, and he thought that was good, and his wife is from Indiana, near Amish country.
Okay.
And he thought that trans juxtaposition. Third time's charm.
Oh,
I'm
man.
Sorry. My vocabulary's been shut down for 3 weeks. Thank you. So. he thought that would work out well. And he actually even has an Amish character in there.
Oh, man.
Who was playing in the game to avoid losing his farm. And he ended up being the actor that played it.
Oh, it wasn't Randy Quaid? Damn.
No. but yeah, it's a real interesting game. And, one of the stories I read, too, he was talking about how hard it was to get made because all the studios kept saying, it's poker movies. It's got to be set in Vegas. And he's like, no, you're missing the point.
Yeah.
This is why this is a funny movie, is because it's set in Indiana. And they just didn't want to hear it. So he eventually just did it on his own. And, of course, when you do it on your own, then you got to, go from film festival to film festival, racking up awards and hoping that somebody picks up the distributed. So I don't know when we're actually going to see it anywhere, but I'm looking forward to seeing Hitting the Nuts when it comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely do a review of that or something.
And what about that name, too?
It's perfect.
Hey, this is Hort Corkins, and I'm listening to Annie Up.
Well, Scott, we have our November 9. Very exciting.
So quickly, didn't it? Even after, like, what, it took 14, 15 days?
Yeah, it went by so fast.
It did.
And I tell you, it's remarkable, the international flavor that is at the final table. Never happened like this before, ever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
More international players than Americans by 6-3. And Czech Republic, Ireland, Belize. I love seeing that because every once in a while our cruises go there or something. And Germany, Ukraine, and Great Britain, and then three Americans. Just incredible. And, of course, Ben Lamb is one of them. We'll talk about him in a little bit.
Yeah, just three Americans. I mean, it's really, I think that's the storyline this year, is that it's always been an international event here. I mean, right. I think they've always had people from 100 or some countries enter the main event. And, of course, you know, people do well in other events, but really this year more than another, it's an international. You got these, you know, six of the nine there. Frenchmen were just cleaning up in the bracelet events.
Yeah, which is too remarkable.
Yeah, so you know, it's really changed. It's not a, you know, it's not an American game anymore, or American series anymore. It's truly an international series, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's why it's called the World Series for a reason. And I have a question for you now. I think I know what you'll say, but I want to bring it up anyway. You know, we've every year since we started the November 9, we always bring it up and say, do we like the delay? Do we think it's, you know, what's the reason they're doing it for? And we always come back to, you know, they want everyone to go back to their hometowns. But now we're looking at six players who are going back to six different countries. And most of these countries don't have Harris properties, don't have World Series places to play there. Are they getting what they wanted with this now? Because let's be frank, everyone who tunes in November, on November 5th to watch us, or 6th or whatever, they're not going to know who these people are. And no matter how, you know what I mean, they're just not going to get the publicity that they were going to get if eight of them were from America and one was from Great Britain or something. You know, we're talking about the Ukraine. I mean, there are no Harrah's Ukraine, you know what I mean? There's no Caesars in the Czech Republic. So does this hurt them now, this delay, and this sort of way to try to drum up publicity?
Well, that's an interesting question, and, you know, I was asked that on Short Stack Radio last night. I'm becoming a regular guest on the Wednesday night, and you can listen into that at PokerEuphoria.com. I think what we're forgetting is that the Caesars brand is really trying to become a worldwide brand, even if they don't have properties there. So in a lot of ways, I think this is exactly what they were hoping for, because now they're going to get a lot of coverage in areas that people may not really recognize the Caesars brand or the World Series of Poker brand. And think about this too, you know, these players are going to become national heroes in a sense in their countries,
right?
You know, when you've got our three Americans, you know, they're obviously going to get generous coverage and, you know, great stuff in their hometowns like always happens. But they're not going to capture the hearts and imaginations of Americans like, you know, the Women's World Cup team might have done.
Right.
But when you're one player from the Czech Republic or one player from Belize or one player from Ukraine, all of a sudden now you've got a whole country rooting for you. And I think those folks are going to have far more media coverage and scrutiny than the three Americans will.
Well, the other thing that comes up now is, you know, ESPN agrees to this with Harrah's because they feel like it's going to be a chance for them to get better ratings and sell more commercials for more money. But really, now you've got six people outside of the country, and the ratings are all American numbers driven.
Yeah,
how many Americans are going to tune in to see if somebody from Belize wins the World Series versus somebody in their backyard or someone they can relate to or whatever? So I really wonder if, regardless of them getting more exposure worldwide, I think the numbers might be down for the viewing here in America.
Yeah, well, and we got two things going on here. We got Caesars Entertainment, which I think is ecstatic that they're getting this coverage around the world, and then you got ESPN, which pays a pretty hefty fee to Caesars for the rights to telecast.
Right.
And you're right. I mean, if they could handpick nine people, six of these people would not be in on the broadcast, at least. And to be honest, probably not any of these nine. I mean, they would pick people that the people are going to tune in to watch. But that's also the you know, excitement of the World Series, is that it's not one of these prefabricated TV shows with, you know, just a big star. So, but certainly, I think ESPN would have loved to have seen you know, one star make it, because that's all you need. Yeah. You know, last year the Grinder story was amazing. You know, Phil Ivey makes the final table a couple years ago. And I think that's really all they wanted. So I imagine there's a lot of folks at ESPN that were sitting there rooting pretty hard for Eric Lindgren.
Yeah.
Down the stretch run. Because at least you're going to get some folks in to watch the pro.
I know that Ben Lamb now has got a pretty decent following after his real breakout year. He's always been a decent player, obviously.
Yeah.
But the breakout year really helped. But let's get into a little bit here. The chip leader is Martin Stasko. And he has a hair above 40 million chips. And that's the other thing, too, you'll notice this year, is a lot of these chip stacks are all bunched together. You know, every year there was always, like, two guys about a million or 3 million or something. They're all between, like, 40 and, like, 14 million or something. Really, one hand can bring a guy who's a short stack to the chip leaders now. And it's going to be a really interesting final table contested. And he's from the Czech Republic. He's the first Czech to ever make a World Series final table. I guess the World Series,
the main event.
And then Hines, which is what was his first name? I can't remember.
Pius.
He's the first German to do it as well. So a lot of firsts in this thing. It's really pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's really a great. And it'll be interesting to see how ESPN dresses up the November 9 into a, you know, if they. I think it's going to be impossible for them not to play off of this international flavor, but I'm really because they always do such a really good broadcast, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more later on. But they always do a really good job with this, so I would hope that they, you know, reflect that kind of flavor in the broadcast and not go cheesy with it.
Cheesy. The other thing too I thought was interesting was the spelling of Owen O'D.
Yeah,
you know, his first name is E-O-G-H-A-N, and it's pronounced Owen. And some people were pronouncing it Ian.
Yeah.
So I don't really know which is proper, but it's just interesting spelling. And then some calling him O'Day and O-D. I'm going to call him Owen O-D just because, you know, that's the last thing I heard before they made the November 9. So, but he's the son of Irish pro Danacha O'D, or Danaka. I'm not sure how you pronounce that either. But he made a main event final table twice. That's so cool that father and son now have made a main event final table. That's never happened before.
Yeah, I mean, you ask somebody who's got the best shot of father-son being, I mean, you would think that Todd Brunson would have a shot to make it and be the Brunsons. But two guys from Ireland. So, I mean, that's another great story. So not only is it this international flavor, but the stories that are with it are too.
Yeah, very cool.
I thought this was very interesting. 26 is the magic age this year. 4 of the 9 people at the final table are 26 years old.
Jeez.
Now, I know youth is the new catchword, but 26, for 4 of them to be 26, that was really interesting to me.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. And it's right. It seems like that's right around where they should be. You know, where you discover the game when you're in your teens. And you get good at it after a few years, and it makes sense. 26 seems to be like right in the wheelhouse for these guys. But yeah, it's not. But there were a lot of young players too. There were what, 3 were like 22 or younger.
Yeah.
Right? Is there one left that can still break Kata's record? Right.
You know, I wondered about that. I was watching for a while, and then I didn't follow it to find out whether that was still the case. But very well could be.
Yeah, I think there's one player left. It might be that Holden guy. I'm not sure. But yeah, there's one player at least I think left that can still break the record. I'm not positive of that. But it's pretty wild. And then the oldest is 49-year-old Badi Bunara.
Yep, representing for all of us with gray hair.
He's the one from Belize, right?
Yeah. And, you know, he has a condo in Fort Lauderdale, too. So there seemed to be some confusion throughout the series. He kept changing his hometown from Fort Lauderdale to Belize City. And so, you know, hey, if I was him, I would ride the Belize train a little bit more than I would the Fort Lauderdale train. So, you know, but it does seem like he splits the time between the two. So,
you know, if we were a Florida-only magazine still, though, we'd be riding that Fort Lauderdale train.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We'd be getting as many interviews with him and photos of him as we could. But now that we're national, he can be from Belize if he wants.
He can be wherever he wants to be, bro.
All right. Yep. I was going to say, we mentioned Ben Lamb.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the funny thing, too, is I wasn't really paying attention long enough to, in the beginning, to realize that they kept saying, he's in the lead for player of the year. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. He's at the final table. Nobody can pass him. Why isn't he just player of the year? And then I forgot, you know, WSOP Europe is going to be figured into the player of the year race. Right. So that should be pretty cool. Him and Helmuth over there fighting for some more points to try to take the title down. But he is the leader right now. We actually wrote about him a little bit in our Oklahoma column this month for our newest issue, because he's just been on a tear.
Yeah.
Absolute tear. You know, he has a victory, his first bracelet of the year. He also has a second and an eighth and a 12th. And but, you know, now that he's on this heater, is it going to hurt him, Scott, to take this time off?
Yeah, I think this is the big question I have is, you know, everybody asks, you know, all right, so you're playing so well and then you take, you know, 4 or 5 months off and come back. Who benefits from that and who hurts from it? And I just got to think that, you know, every year there's somebody that is just in the zone.
Yeah.
At the series and just playing the best poker of their lives. And I'm not saying that he can't come back 5 months now and pick right back up or even come back better than then. But I would think if I was on the heater that he is now, I would have wanted to get this thing over with right away rather than wait and come back. So I would say arguably he's the one that's going to be hurt the most by the layoff. But, you know, but we'll see.
Have you seen his stare? Man, that guy can stare right through you, man. It's scary. He looks like this, you know, sort of like, you know, hey, I'm just the guy just chilling and playing poker and having fun. But then as in the hand, he, oh, my God, he turns evil. He's just scary looking. He's so scary, you know, and I would hate to be up against that. And did you notice nobody had their sunglasses on at the final table?
Yeah, yeah.
And somebody, I thought somebody on Twitter was saying, did they have to not wear them? And someone else said, yeah, they can't wear them. And I have no idea whether it was true or not. I didn't really investigate. But there was one player who had the sunglasses on his head, but he wouldn't put them down. And nobody wore sunglasses. And I thought, that's kind of weird, especially since Blue Shark Optics is like one of the official sponsors of the World Series. And then if they told them they couldn't wear them, I'm sure that they would not be happy about that. So
yeah, I can't imagine that's the case. And you know, it felt good for our good friend Kerry at Blue Shark, because a lot of players were wearing his glasses on the TV coverage.
Yes, yes. And I saw his banner a few times, you know, during some of the B-roll footage, as they say, you know, and stuff. So he definitely had a real busy summer out there, and I'm happy for him.
Let's finish up with some of the math here before we get into more fun stuff. Everyone's guaranteed $782,115. Not a bad little payday already.
Yeah.
We'll get $8,711,956. Much better payday.
Exactly. Very close to 8 million more than ninth place. So you don't want to finish ninth, man.
Blinds are going to start pick up back at 250,000, 500,000. I'd love to be in a tournament where the blinds are that high.
Jeez.
Is that ever going to happen? With 50,000 antes. So we mentioned short stack Sam Holden. You still have 25 big blinds, Chris.
Yeah. Big blinds. You lose the big blind number when you have to put in 50,000 for an ante too.
But two double ups, he's the chip leader.
Yeah, yep, exactly.
One chip leader, he's probably in second place depending on who he doubles through. So
and the official date when they return is November 5th, and the champion will be expected to be crowned 2 days later. So it's always around that middle first second week of November, and should be pretty exciting.
I don't wish any ill will on the folks. I'm waiting for the year where somebody knocks two people out.
Yeah.
Unless they had it and foils their whole comeback in the heads-up match.
Yeah.
Days later, and you're right, with the chip distribution this year, it very well could happen. You know, you could get a hand where everybody's about even, and boom, you know, one guy knocks everybody out. So.
The other thing would be kind of funny, too, is if that happened before it was November 9 and it was November 8 because they knocked two guys out in the last
year. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because the World Poker Tour had that happen to them once, where they had a five-handed final table because two guys got knocked out. So that would be funny. The November 8, like, yeah, why are we calling it that, you know? But, you know, the World Series and ESPN, they're always trying to make it better. They're always trying to do things differently, think outside the box. You know, and this year, they provided us with a tasty little treat this past week and a half or whatever it was, you know, with some near-live coverage. Mm-hmm. And you know, you'd seen some of that stuff kind of before on ESPN 360, and this wasn't exactly, you know, unprecedented. I mean, they had done this before with other things, like made-to-order thing. I think Full Tilt Poker did a live one from, I don't know, it was The Win or something. I don't know, but they've tried to do live poker before on TV. It just wasn't as successful, and this was definitely the best effort and attempt of the bunch. As we said before, I think it was broadcast on like a 30-minute delay to give players, you know, some time away from when the hand happens so that people can just text them right away so they know.
Yeah.
And it gave ESPN a chance to clean up stuff too, I guess, foul language and things like that, and or whatever. But you know, I my hat's off to Lon McCarron. And I mean, there was a lot of people doing it. Olivier Bousquet and Helmuth, and even Norman did some. And but Antonio Sfondiari and Lon McCarron, they did the majority of the coverage. Mm-hmm. And it is not easy, man. I mean, you know how many times you and I have done television now for the Windy City Poker Championships and for some of the Chad Brown stuff. And when we have a chance to do it, you know, multiple takes, we're still stepping on each other's toes or you know, flubbing our words or whatever. And, I mean, to never have done live poker like that. Now, Lon has been, you know, he's a seasoned pro. He's done absolutely live stuff. Pro. He's done Strikeforce, you know, MMA and other things. So, but even so, I mean, you're taking what is probably the equivalent of paint drying and making it exciting. And it's not easy to do. My hat's off. You know, I had seen some people, you know, giving crap to other people about the way that, you know, Antonio was doing stuff or whatever. But really, I thought he was really good. And I felt like they made it exciting, especially like, you know, the dead time that is involved here.
Yeah,
you know, you and I sometimes we're doing it, and we sit there and we're staring at the hands on the monitor while we're getting ready to say something, and we're quiet for like 30 seconds because we can't think of anything to say. You do that on national TV, and that's the death knell, man.
You're
screwed. And so, really, I can't say enough. I mean, they did a really good job, and you know, I would not want to be them. I would not. The pressure is just huge. And some of the other things too. Antonio, I mean, he a couple of times was just spot on with the cards. And now you can't see the cards till the hand is over, and you definitely can't see the cards if there's no flop. So you never even get to see the whole cards unless there's a flop. But he was putting people on exact hands, and to say that publicly, you know, you're really putting yourself out there. And he was spot on a lot more than he wasn't. And it was just a testament of how good of a player he is and how good of a player you really have to be to do something like that. Really incredible stuff.
Second, everything you said, it was just amazing to me how well they did. And, you know, the other thing, too, is we love the international flavor of this, but, you know, let's be honest, we're ugly Americans here. Trying to get these names down, right?
Yeah.
It's hard, even when you're guide in front of you. And then to do it quickly and make that recall and get those names right, I mean, there's just so many pitfalls that they had this year. And the small portion I got to watch, I was very, very impressed with how little they made mistakes.
You know,
and I really hope that people aren't out there criticizing them, because they really have no idea how hard it is and how well they did.
The thing that I liked about it, too, is even though a lot of it, you know, you're sitting there like, oh, my God, I want to see a hand. I want to see a flop, you know. And I'm not jonesing for the all-in crap that you see all the time. But it really made it feel like I was watching, like, a baseball game or something where – they were talking, like, because, you know, they got to fill a lot of dead time in a baseball game, too.
Absolutely.
You know, the guy spitting and calling time, and, you know, they're on the mound with a meeting and, you know, going to the bullpen. And there's a lot of stuff. It felt like that. It felt like these guys are just talking poker, talking scenarios, and they're forced to talk about a lot of stuff that you may not be able to get when you're watching a high-stakes poker, because they're cutting out hours and hours of hands and just giving you the meat. And so I really felt like it was a legitimate event now, if that makes sense. You know, it was sort of like a sport. It felt like here are these two guys talking poker and talking scenarios and talking personalities and talking stories, which is what you would do when you watch a baseball game. And, you know, baseball sometimes is very boring too, but they have talented announcers, and that's what I think these guys did. And as we said, there are, you know, a lot of pitfalls, and there were a lot of mistakes in these things these guys made. But one of the things that I liked most was, you know, Lon McCarron, if he called the wrong name or something, he would correct himself right away.
Yeah.
He wouldn't just be like, you know, and forget about it or just move on. You know, they would correct each other and stuff, and that's just the way you got to be. You know, it's okay. You're human. We know you're live, and that's the best part. You know, right in the beginning, you could tell they were a little rough because it was the first time they were ever doing it. They probably cued Lon to start his little introduction speech, not realizing that there was an introduction speech being recorded and played already. So he started talking over a pre-recorded thing, and that's how it started. That's how it was announced to the world. So I felt bad then. You know, and a couple of times, you know, they were stumbling over words and stuff like that, or getting the wrong names. But it's impossible because you're in a booth, you know, like that's, you know, I don't know how far away it was. Like, we weren't there when they set up that part of it, but I'm sure they were far enough away where they couldn't see the cards. you know, they can hear what the, if you had a really good floor there calling out the action, it helped. And they had some other things. They had people, spotters, you know, calling out bets for them or putting them into the computer, you know, mics right to the van or whatever to put the stats up and the graphics and things. So it wasn't easy to do that. But if they called out the wrong name or if they announced the wrong pots or whatever, they definitely made a correction. They tried to make everything right. And there were some weird moments, too, like players standing up in front of the cameras, you know, because they're just totally forgetting that it's not the official feature table or whatever it was. And
Right. You're
sitting there and you're staring at a blank T-shirt for like 2 minutes. And you're like, hello, someone, the producer, say camera 5, please, or something, you know. But I really liked it. And one of the things I was trying to equate it to was it's kind of like online poker for these guys, these announcers, and for the crew and stuff, because you only have a certain amount of time to react to these things. You can't just grab the B-roll footage and insert it in the editing room and say, oh, we'll cut out this guy's T-shirt for 5 seconds. Right. Somebody's got to be there saying, camera 2, or Lon's got to be there making the right call. And you only have a certain amount of time to do it. And if you make a mistake, you're screwed. You know, you made a mistake. And it's out there in the ethernet, you know, just like, you know, if you're playing online poker and you make a mistake, you know, because you're pressured for 15 seconds to make your decision, it's going to happen. So it was kind of like the equivalent of online poker. It was kind of weird.
Well, I think a couple things really worked in your favor. You mentioned that other people have done live poker before, too. And the one I remember was like a Turning Stone event several years ago. It was flat because live poker is flat.
Yeah.
And I think what made this work was a confluence of a lot of great things. One, it's an event that people were following.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that people wouldn't follow an event at Turning Stone or somewhere else, but I mean, it's a World Series, so if you're a poker player, you're following it on Twitter, you're following it on the website, you're following it on somewhere else. So, you know, you've got a vested interest in watching this and seeing how it plays out. So that helps. And two, you know, having the multiple tables to choose from. And
yeah.
Not just, you know, a static camera on one where you bring in updates, but being able to go back and forth between the two tables. I mean, that kills some of the dead time in a broadcast. And so that certainly helped. And then, of course, then you add the whole ESPN crew to it as well, too. I mean, it was real comforting for me to turn on and see Lon McCarron there.
Yeah. And he, I mean, just a consummate professional. And, you know, they brought in other pros. They did a little, you know, Kara Scott did interviews to try to fill some time. Or, you know, I mean, some of the things, too, like they would come back from a commercial and they'd be on break. And there'd be nothing to – they'd go right back to commercial or something because there'd be nothing for them to do or – you know, that kind of stuff was kind of awkward. But they seemed to iron that out by the end with either interviews with Kara or going to the booth and having them talk about something specific. They probably had stuff planned. They probably – you know, I'm sure they planned for it, but every once in a while it would happen where they would come back from commercial and be like, you're back to the World Series and they're on break. And like, okay, well, you know, what the hell? But other than that, it was really good.
Let me ask you this, though, because I didn't watch nearly as much of this as you did. I mean, I caught watched it specifically on Tuesday night, the last night, but I watched a little bit in the bar on the night before with no sound on. So, of course, I'm, you know, missing part of it. But to me, it seemed like a lot of times they were on break.
Yeah, it did.
And I'm like, I didn't hear the sound, so I didn't know what was going on, but it certainly seemed like a lot of breaks.
Yeah, you know, some of them could have been hand-for-hand stuff. Some of it could have been when they, you know, and the other thing, too, is, you know, when they had dinner break, the broadcast ended. So that made sense. But there was one day where I got my DVR and I looked at it and it said, it was like 6.5 hours of coverage. It was like on one episode. And they really did it. It was Olivier Bousquet and that other guy, Duckman or whatever his name was. And, you know, at 6 hours. I mean, can you imagine doing that for 6 hours live? It's just crazy. But yeah, it did seem like there were a lot of breaks. But I think they have breaks, like a 5 minute break after every blind thing, and then they have the official break for the color ups and stuff. So there were a lot of breaks.
Okay. Right.
But you know, the other thing too is you're in a bar, you're getting drunk, and it seems like time's going faster than when you're just sitting there watching it. You know.
Well, I know. I was just there for one meal, and I'm like, half the broadcast was people just, you know, the technical people standing around looking at the table, and I'm like, wow.
A lot of things.
It's supposed to be like 2 hour levels. So
the interesting thing about this too is it brought up a lot of other problems or at least things that they have to work out soon. And one of them was, you know, Daniel Grano, great personality, right? And he's every year he's voted like the favorite player and of people and whatever overall. And so they always put him at the feature table. But when you're at a feature table, You're not allowed to wear more than two patches. You're not allowed to use your phone. And there are all these special rules. Now, some of those rules may have been intact outside, but they were bringing up, a lot of these players are bringing it up that, you know, these are these rules that they're also, their cards are also being exposed. Whereas if you're not at the feature table, your cards aren't being exposed, or the outside feature table. You know, you don't have to show your cards to a whole cam that's going to be broadcast for the whole world to see and found out on Twitter in 30 minutes or in texts in 30 minutes. And so these guys are put up, even though they're popular, and because he's a good pro, Daniel Negreanu is put under more scrutiny and more disadvantage because he's a popular pro. And I wondered if, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, these guys get punished for being popular, for being good. Now, maybe it's a small price to pay, but Jean-Robert Ballon was talking about, hey, if you're going to at least put us on the table, let us put as many patches on us as we can so we can make some easy cheddar, you know? And,
yeah.
You know, and they have no choice to be on TV either. It's not their choice. They can't say, no, don't put me on TV. No, the tournament directors choose you and put you on. You have to go play there or pay the penalty, you know, by sitting out or something. And I wonder if that's really fair to these guys. You're telling them how many patches they can put on, and but it's not your choice to be on TV.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess the bottom line is it's your choice to enter the tournament or not, which, you know, to me is a kind of a lame fallback, but it is the fallback.
Yeah.
But, you know, the one thing that really bothers me, as you're right, is the limits on patches. Now, I could kind of understand a reason in the past when they didn't want .coms on there, you know, because they're, you know, whatever their worry was about the online thing. But, you know, here's the thing. You know, you watch a NASCAR broadcast, those teams can have any logos they want, and it doesn't have to be a NASCAR.
Right.
So I don't really – I do think it's an unfair rule for Caesars to put in place for players. You know, if players can – put, you know, 100 patches on them, let them put 100 patches on it, and you got to sell your series sponsorships, letting people know, hey, you know, we're going to do a really good job of promoting Jack's beef links, but somebody else might have Slim Jim on the player, and that's fine, so just understand that. Where I think the opposite is that they're like, you know, hey, they want to freeze out any competition for their sponsors. So I can understand from a business standpoint, but it's really unfair for players not to be able to do what they need to do.
Well, you know, and speaking of Negreanu, there's something I have to bring up. Everybody, I think, who watched this saw this. Every single time Negreanu played, he would just go on and on and on about the no talking during a hand when you're in a hand, even when you're heads up. And this is the rule that I brought up when we were at the Palm Beach and we were playing there, and I said something to somebody, and the guy's like, you can't talk. And I was like, what are you talking about? We're heads up. And then he said, you couldn't. So to quote Negreanu, he said something like, whoever made the rule is not logical and doesn't make any sense, doesn't understand the game, it's so stupid. And he kept saying this like every single broadcast that he was on, because it is, it's truly stupid. And it actually began like this huge Twitter back and forth with Matt Savage and a bunch of people. Even I texted him and said, hey, you know, it's true, when I was at the thing, you know, I'm not going to get into it now, but when I was there, they said you couldn't talk. And, you know, Matt was like, he couldn't believe it. You know, he just couldn't believe it. So eventually, you know, he kept talking about it. Here's what the deal was. Negreanu was trying to talk to somebody about you know, you got sixes or whatever the hell it was, and they said, you can't talk. You can't talk even when your head's up. And so he went on this tear about it every episode. Finally, they're like, all right, let's just get Jack Effel and talk to him and ask him.
Yeah.
So Kara Scott gets him, but not on camera. She gets him and talks to him off camera. And she said that he said that you can't disclose the contents of your hand when you're talking to him, but you can talk. So I'm like, okay, well, then the rule is that you can talk, and everybody's wrong. Because so then when it got back to Bousquet and the other guy, they were saying that, yeah, the rule doesn't make sense. I'm sure they'll change that rule real soon. And I'm like, wait a minute. They just said that the rule makes sense now if what she said is correct and that everyone is ill-informed. So then it just totally confused me, and I gave up. I mean, I totally have given up on this now. I don't know what the rule is. I mean, I can shoot an email to Seth or the guys there and see what they have to say, but I don't know what the rule is now. I am totally confused by it, because now at the end of the coverage, guys were talking to each other, and they weren't saying anything. So now I'm totally confused. Can you talk to each other and but not bring up the contents of your own hand, which has always been the case for as long as I've known it? And now I'm just totally confused by it. I am really. And hats off to Daniel for really – he is saying stuff like, this might be my last series. I can't take this anymore. Which, you know, is not true, but he's that upset by it. And
well, it's a huge part of his game.
Yes, exactly.
So if you're telling him that he can't do it, that's like telling somebody they can't wear sunglasses or phones or, you know, any of the other stuff that are generally allowed that they think helps them, gives them an advantage. So,
well, if that is the rule that you can now talk, that's not fair, because then you put him through all that and he didn't get to play. And you can tell he was frazzled by it a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not, you know, he's a professional or whatever. But, well, a couple other players that I wanted to bring up. Sean Deeb, I mean, got to be the most professional, classiest way I've ever seen somebody handle a bad beat ever. It was such a sick hand. It was raised. It got to him. He re-raised. Guy on his left, 4-bet. The other guy folded, gets back to Sean Deeb. He 5-bets, then his opponent shoves. Deeb instantly calls with ace-ace, sees that he's up against ace-six offsuit. The guy was making moves. 6 comes on the flop, 6 of clubs on the river.
Oh, man.
And it was a massive pot sky. It would have put him in the top 10 of chips easy on, like, day four? He would have 450,000 chips. Totally crippled him. He would basically be knocked out the next hand. He had like 20 grand left a couple hands later. Took it like a pure gentleman and even did a post-interview with Kara Scott, and which is pure class. I mean, he, you know how he talks fast and stuff. I mean,
yeah,
he was there talking fast and everything, but he never had anything bad to say. Never like blew up, never cried, never yelled, nothing. Just, I mean, just kind of like basically shrugged. I mean, he might have been steaming inside, but he... just pure class, and it was like the worst beat I've ever seen. I mean, that is like so brutal, and he would have been like a tournament leader. Oh my God, just pure class. And that's something I don't know. I mean, I know at the home game you and I have a lot of fun and stuff, and if something like that happened at the home game, I might have lost it like Gambit lost it. But you know, in the public place like that, I'm pretty reserved. Even when I get a bad beat, I kind of just get up and keep it to myself. But I don't know if I could have done it there. That is some serious life-changing money that he could have been in good position for if he'd won that hand. And oh my God, unbelievable.
Well, I was really impressed with the short time we get to spend with him at the Jacksonville.
Yeah.
And I think a couple things that I took from just reads I got on his personality, I think that speak to how he could probably become here. One, he's just a mathematical genius.
Right.
And I think part of that, it's not just being able to figure odds and knowing stuff like that, but understanding that stuff like this is going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously it doesn't all the pain of it in the one tournament you don't want it to catch up to you at, but I do think he has a good understanding that this stuff just happens, and that he's got the best of it several times as well too, so I think that's part of it. And then also I think he's just so used to playing so many hands online. I mean, we were amazed that he was playing however many tables online while playing in a $5,000. We were sitting there talking to him.
Yeah.
You know, and if you play that often, I mean, you're going to have those bad beats that much more often than everybody else. So I think he's probably, even at his young age, kind of immune to the fact that the real pain of this stuff happening. So I could be wrong, but that's the kind of what I took away from
him. I mean, he's so advanced for his age. You know, it's just remarkable. And I was thoroughly impressed. And a lot of players, too, interviewed with Kara Scott after they got knocked out and, you know, showed class and just it's really, to me, I would just be sick. Maybe because it's so much more money to me than it is to them. I don't know, but I would just been talk to the press. No way, you know. And I am the press, so I mean, for me to say that, it's got to mean something. All right, well, just one more thing on the players. I found it real interesting how many players were really ticked off that had to show their cards, you know, and actually would rather take a penalty than show, you know, try to force their cards into the muck and stuff. And there were some documented cases of it happening where, you know, one guy was in the floor, were arguing with each other, and he was like saying, you know, you signed a contract, you need to show your, and he's like, show me the contract, I signed no contract. I mean, and the guy took a penalty instead of showing his cards. And I just wonder, what do you think of that, Scott? I mean, getting penalties because of television entertainment in a poker tournament that they're paying for and not actual poker rules? I actually created a poll on AntyUpMagazine.com/forum. So everybody can weigh in on this to see if they should be able to get penalties because they don't want to show their cards to a camera. What do you think?
Well, you know, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because I don't know the whole contract situation here, whether they're talking just about the general rules on the back of your ticket. or whether there was an actual something that once you're on TV, they make you sign a release as right. well, too. So without knowing exactly what that is and what's involved, it's tough for me to say. But, I get it. I understand that that people are upset that, information is leaking, but that's the new... That's the new world of poker. That's why poker is so popular now. You got to keep thinking about that. If poker never made it on TV, back of the whole cards and Moneymaker, we wouldn't be chagrining that the participation this year was just 6,800. It wouldn't be anywhere near that and everywhere else. So you got to think of it from an overall standpoint that the overall poker experience is better now, even if certain individual parts of it suck, and particularly when you win a $10,000, the biggest event of the year. I think there's got to be a little bit more understanding there. But at the same time, too, you're right. You've got this contrived thing going on. You enter a tournament and you expect to be playing like everybody else, and you've got one or two or three tables playing differently than everyone else.
Yeah.
And that's tough. But again, at the end of the day, you have an option. You have an option of not entering this tournament.
Yeah, it's true.
And not playing if you don't want to. And if these kind of things become so onerous that so many people quit playing, they'll change.
Yeah.
But I don't see that happening. I just don't think that many people actually cared that much that they're not going to play.
All right, well, some final thoughts. I really thought that this live coverage really was interesting to watch, despite not knowing the cards for the most part. There were some kinks, but they ironed them out. And... I just felt like the coverage had some charm to it and some human quality, and I really appreciated it.
You got that ESPN sense of it, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously it was different. It wasn't the polished final product that we'll see, but you really knew it was an ESPN production. I thought the intros were good, the commentary. So other than just the fact that it looks like the live episode of ER, which, you realize how much the post-production really makes it better.
Yeah.
Other than that, it was exactly what you expected from ESPN.
And, what I thought was really funny was on a lot of the forums, including ESPN's own forum, there were people complaining about the coverage because they thought that was – the old way was better, they said. I want to see the old – we're like, hello, the old way is still going to happen. You're still going to get your backstories of the players who have family members who are dying or who made it to America on a raft or whatever it is. Just to play in the main event, and it's gonna happen. It's just that this was bonus coverage.
Yeah,
I'm all for it. It's like, hey, the boss calls you in, he says, we're gonna give you a bonus. No, I don't want the bonus. Pay me my normal salary. this is just the additional stuff. You didn't have to watch it. You're still gonna get what you want. And I'm hoping that this eventually might serve as the most of what the main coverage was going to be in the future, so they might take those other broadcasts and show other events, because they've given us our extra coverage.
I think that's a great point because, one of our I shouldn't say our, I know it's one of my complaints, I imagine you probably agree too, is that, when they actually start the real broadcast, it's, a couple episodes of some bracelet events and then 2 weeks, or I mean 2 weeks, but
2 months.
2 months worth of main event, and I really don't care about that one particular tournament that much in the early stages.
Right.
And I think this is the best way to do the live thing because, I think back a couple years ago when we talked about, how you didn't know who the World Series champion was until it actually aired because you didn't want to be surprised.
All right.
And that's really what people want now is that, and so they, they did November 9, so, they don't know the end, but now you're taking this event and you're being able to follow along almost like you would a normal sporting event, and it's a good way to do the main event, and then you've got the November 9. I would be happy if they just didn't do anything with the main event, aside from the live stuff, or the 30-minute delay. I keep calling it live, but it's not.
Right.
Fill in on the stuff that people probably weren't watching anywhere near as much interest. And probably have just as many good, compelling stories.
Yeah, because they're gonna go to the outside tables a lot more, and they're gonna tell all these stories and everything. But really, if it's not been on ESPN, then you don't really think of it. Okay, I haven't seen it yet. But since it's already been out there and it's there, and everyone's been following it already, because the people who are watching it every Tuesday night are the ones who are gonna watch the live stuff too. Why not just do like you said and show a couple of other Hold'em events and a couple of other mixed ones and. I don't know, but the one thing I do, and this is my last thought on this, is Do you think now those future broadcasts, though, will lose the genuine feel? I mean, are there really people out there who really think that Lon and Norman now are reacting to this stuff live? I mean, really, we know now that Lon was not with Norman. We know that anything they react to now is phony because we know that they were there for the live stuff and we saw the live stuff. So now having them go, oh, it's a king of dying, you know, hey, you know, we already know that you were there and weren't really there for this. And I mean, is that going to lose its genuineness?
Yeah,
or?
I think the type of people that thought that was genuine before are probably the same type of people that won't be able to watch the live and then make that connection that you're talking about.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not picking on people that don't understand the post-production part of this because, you know, these shows do a really good job of making you think that they are sitting there watching it. So it's real clever. So, I mean, even some real smart people, I think, probably fall for that. But no, I don't think it's that big a deal.
Okay. I just it feels so weird to think that now Lon and Norman are going to sit back and react to these things. And it's like, you know, it's just so weird. At least before, you kind of felt like, all right, maybe Norman and Lon weren't there during all of this. And now they're reacting to it in a booth that they've never seen before. At least you had that. But now knowing that they're there, sitting there watching this and taking notes, and which I know they've done in the past because they say, you know, I've run into them at the main event and talked to them. Yeah. So, but it's just so weird now to know that here's Lon calling the action for this table this way, and then the next month he's calling it again an entirely different way as if he's there another time. And it's just kind of weird to me. It's disingenuous almost.
Well, I think the other thing, too, is it's really going to drive home how good poker is in a post-production setting rather than live.
Yeah.
You know, I think people are going to appreciate the fact that this is a game or sport, whatever you want to call it, that's better post-production, even if it's contrived with a lot of things, because the pace is much better and the you know, the commentary is much better. You know, even as well as Lon and Antonio did on these live broadcasts, and they really did a good job. I mean, it really, you can't put that up against what you're going to see a couple months from now.
Yeah.
And you know, put a test case out of 100 people, and you know, I'd be shocked if more than 10 prefer the live.
Yeah, absolutely. Overall, though, plus, I mean, you know, overall, I thought it was a great thing. And again, like I said, it's bonus coverage. So even if you didn't like it, how can you complain? You didn't have to watch it. It's just bonus coverage. And if you really like poker, I think ESPN and the World Series did a real good job.
Dzień dobry, nazywam się Sabina Gadecki i ty słuchasz do Ante Up.
Okay, well, we mentioned that we are slowly playing some crazier games in our home game, but we're trying to avoid the slippery slope, and we're walking the same tight line with Hand of the Week. All right, you know, we're having trouble getting a lot of good submissions, so we're having to be a little more crafty with them, so I'm trying not to let any crazy game that somebody sends in make it on the show unless there's a good reason, but this week... our good friend Ken Engstrom wrote in with a game called Irish Hold'em High-Low, Chris.
Oh, no.
All right, now the first thing I want to start off with is, you know, I know we have a lot of listeners in Ireland. I want to know whether this is a game that was legitimately created by Irish people and that this name is a badge of honor, or whether this is one of these ugly American despicable kind of things.
Yeah,
so if we decide to play this game, we can rename it appropriately if it's not something that the Irish people were proud of.
Okay.
I hope somebody will answer us.
Okay.
All right, well, he starts the handoff by asking us in the home game, what's the most efficient method of handling a two-deck situation? Shuffle ahead or shuffle behind? Of course, that answer is use one deck. It's amazing how it takes care of that problem.
Oh, man. Well, if you have to give them a legitimate answer, it's shuffle behind.
Yeah, okay.
They don't have to post blinds. They don't have to, you know, the person ahead always has to post a blind, and then, you know, the person behind is not in the way of the dealing. So the person behind is definitely the best way to go.
I'm pretty sure the legitimate answer was one deck. But all right, let's get on the Irish Hold'em High-Low. All right, here's how it plays. You get four cards like an Omaha, but you discard two after the flop. And then, but you don't have to use both cards at like Omaha to make your hand, just one card.
But you can play zero cards too, right? It's just regular hold 'em after discarding two.
Yeah, all I know is he says you don't have to use both cards like Omaha, just one card like Hold'em, which is incorrect.
Yeah, it's incorrect. And also, how about the low? Do you have to play both for the low, or can you play just one for the low?
Yeah, I believe it is 8 or better.
And you can play just one card for the low in your hand?
Yes, it's just one card, so.
Okay.
Yeah, so you don't have to use both cards.
Oh, man. Already we're caught behind the eight ball here because we really don't know what we're doing. But
all right, we'll see whether it actually plays out here. But he said they're also playing at loose pot limit preflop. Meaning they were making opening raises of 1.5 to 2x pot preflop, and then strict pot limit postflop.
Jeez.
So essentially trying to make it easy for them to figure out the pot preflop, and then after that, then obviously you can count the pot down.
All right, I'm calling Croker or whatever that game was. These guys got to be drunk.
Yeah, of course we solved this problem by making the blinds the same, right?
Yeah.
And surprisingly enough, their blinds in this game are quarter-quarter as well.
Hmm.
So there shouldn't be too much confusion over what the pot size bet is. But that's all right. This is our game. That's beyond the hand right here.
All right.
All right. And they're playing three-handed, too.
Oh, my God. A high-low game with four cards, three-handed, with loose pot limit pre-flop, strict pot limit after the flop. Wow, these guys are desperate.
With three people, you have to have action games. You know, if you're playing games where people just fold every time, then it's pretty boring. So,
wow.
I'll give them credit for that.
All right.
All right, our heroes in the small blind was Squiggly 21. The button limps, and he looks down at Ace of Diamonds, Ace of Hearts, Deuce of Hearts, Tray of Hearts.
Jeez.
That's a pretty good hand, I think.
It's a good hand for Omaha, and it's an okay hand for Hold'em because, you know, yeah, you got the aces, but everybody has four cards, so the aces are just like an Omaha. Well, you know, I think it'd be totally cracked. I mean, you got the ace deuce for the low, but do you break up your aces if two lows come and all unders to your aces? Oh, my God. This is brutal. Why do you play this game? Okay, well, yeah, it's a good hand. We got the nut flush draw, backups for the low. If it looks like it's a scary board, but we can make a low to get half, and maybe a wheel or something. So,
lots of wheel cards, which would be great because it's cool.
Yeah.
All right, so what do you want to do?
I will make it the loose pot, whatever that would be.
Yeah.
I think, just to get some money in there, and because it's only three-handed, so
we got a limp or two. If it's three-handed, so you gotta juice it as much as you can to build those pots up, particularly with a big hand like this.
Yeah, the button limps. There's 75 out there, so you can now bet 75 more because you're in the blind. So, that's probably $1.50 pot. So that's something for them to have to call if you have a quarter invested. So I'd make it 75 more.
All right. He raises the two total.
Okay, I forgot it's not pot, it's loose pot. That's a good raise.
Yep. And both opponents call. So we got a $6 pot.
Nice.
A pretty good hand.
With a favorite going in.
All right, the flop is Ace of Spades, Queen of Clubs, Five of Spades.
Okay, well, this is pretty straightforward now.
Top set. We also have a wheel draw, but we can't have...
Right. I think
we're gonna have to discard two cards.
I think that this is pretty self-playing. I mean, you never throw away a hand hoping to get half when you already have the nuts of half. I mean, you have a made hand with top set. The low doesn't get there. You screwed yourself. So I'm not going to throw away deuce tray. I mean, ace and keep deuce tray here, hoping to make a wheel or hoping to make a low for just half when I know I have the nuts to half already. So pretty standard stuff. We're first to act too, right?
Yeah, we're first to act. And he says the opponents are both loose and will call big bets with any two pair, any combo draw, probably any decent flush draw, and probably any decent low draw.
Yeah.
Exactly the kind of people I want to like.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm betting pot here and letting them call it and see what happens.
All right, that's exactly what we do. We bet pot for $6. The big blind folds. The button calls quickly and quietly.
Okay. it can
all
be
right, so I wonder if he wrapped his chips in bubble wrap or something.
All right, so we bet. I don't know what they gave from that. I mean, we bet six. Got a quick, quiet call from somebody.
I call.
Probably, I mean, if you, you know, if you go with the basic rudimentary tells, they say a quick call and is a draw. So perhaps this guy's got like 2-3 of clubs or something in his hand, or I mean, 2-3 of spades or something in his hand. So I don't know. I'm gonna have to just know that I have the nuts going to the turn and see what happens.
Yep. All right. So the pot's $18. We have Squeakley 13 behind. And now it comes to our point where we hit a discard, and as you mentioned, you're not going to break your made hand. But, you know, he was curious what the equity is on the two, and he actually ran it on twodimes.net.
Yeah.
And the pocket aces have an EV of 60, a little bit more than 63%, and the deuce tray of 36%.
Yeah, that makes sense, because the deuce tray, you know, is still only getting half the pot if it makes the low. And then it has to make the wheel to maybe scoop. And even then, you got the spade you're up against to pull that away from. So it makes sense that it's less than 50%. Whereas the set of aces, you know, flush draws still have to get there. And they still have to get there without pairing the board. And it's guaranteed the high end. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, yeah, of course you're going with the aces here.
And then, of course, you know, because it's poker, you get creative. And he wonders if he had the deuce of spades, tray of spades in his hand, would that change it much? Since there's two spades on the board.
Right.
And it's actually almost a coin flip.
Yeah, well, that makes sense because you got a lot more outs for the high as well.
Yep.
But, yeah, since you don't have that, and there's no reason to, you know.
So let me ask you, I mean, I'm not trying to get off topic on the hand here, but if your hand was deuce of spades, tray of spades there, how much longer do you think before you throw away the deuce or tray? Or do you?
Well, you know, I guess because it's three-handed, I would consider it a little more, because if we were full table, I would not, because I know the bigger flush draws out there, and I'm still only playing for half the wheel, probably half the pot. So, you know, I can scoop with my set of aces. I may not be able to scoop with my flush draw, you know. And if the flush doesn't get there and the low doesn't get there, if it comes two paints that are red, you know, I've totally bilked myself out of half the pot. Whereas
it's been a pretty big pot right now.
Yeah, and yeah, no, I still think I throw it away. And then I hand you the cards, and you look at them and give me that, I don't know, look.
I mean, this was the real pain in Crazy Pineapple. I mean, we've played Crazy Pineapple in our home game for a long time. And almost every time we do it, there's a situation where someone takes like 7 hours
yeah.
to discard their one card. And it's almost always situations like this contrived one we just came up with where, you know, you've got a made hand, but you're not sure whether that made hand can hold up to the end, and you got a lot of opponents, so is it better to go for your draw, which needs to still get there, but if it gets there, you're going to profit more from. and that's why, you know, we always like to say we use an Ecedrin bottle for the button.
And the problem with for them is, you know, that they're just pretty much about to turn their cards face up, because you know what they have now.
Yeah, exactly. Know
you know, and it's like, okay, you know, so, yeah, it's a shame. But, yeah, in this case, like I said, even if it's the deuce of spades and the tray of spades, I do think I'm still playing the aces. It's a made hand. Even if it's 50-50, it's still made, you know, 50-50 statistically, but, you know, realistically, you still have the best hand. And even if the flush gets there on a turn, you can still lose. And the other hand, the aces could still have won. So I'm sticking with the aces no matter what, I think.
All right. Well, that's what our hero did. And the turn is the jack of diamonds. So our board now is ace of spades, queen of clubs, five of spades, jack of diamonds.
Okay.
So if someone was playing king 10 or or something like that, they've caught up to us. But no flush. And the good news is the low is getting...
Yeah.
Less likely to get there.
Right.
So what we really want to do, because we don't have an opportunity to scoop now.
Well, we still have 10 outs if we're losing. I might be willing to bet here. I only have 13. There's 18 in the pot. So I might be willing to bet. But if I do, it'd probably be all of it. So.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I check and control for the river. Maybe you'll. Maybe you know. I don't know. Jeez. No, I think I'm betting. I don't.
I mean, here's the thing. I don't. You look at the card that would beat you. You're kicking at King 10.
Right. You have to throw away two cards to keep King 10 with a huge
King
bet like
10
this.
With that huge bet. It just seems really unlikely to me.
Unless it's King Ten of Spades, it's the only hand I could put somebody on.
Exactly.
Keeping. Right.
Exactly. And at that point, even if we're wrong, we still have outs to boat up.
Yeah.
To catch up. So, you know, there's lots of times that the monsters under the bed come out, and you know, we get scooped by them. But I don't think this is one of them.
Yeah, I really
I'm
specifically
pretty sure that we got the best hand, yeah. And if not, I'm fine putting my last 13 in to draw out.
Yeah, and we're talking three-handed. There are only 8 other cards out there, and 2 of them have to be King of Spades, Ten of Spades, and in the same hand. It's pretty difficult for that to have been the hand. I mean, it is a nut flush draw. But I think I'm happy betting. I'm probably just going to put it all in here. And if I'm wrong, I got 10 outs to boat up or quad. So let's get it all in there.
All right. That's what we do. And his opponent gives him the old, well, I guess I have to call line.
Oh, man. So that means he's ahead then. We're ahead.
And opponent turns over King of Spades.
No.
10 of Spades.
No! All right, well, we got a chance, though. We still can win, but wow, it is those 2 exact cards. Let's just put them on the right hand to call. Oh, my God.
Yeah, pretty sick there.
That's, pair the board. Pair the board.
River does not pair the board.
Oh.
We lose the hand, but we have good cheer about it, knowing that that we couldn't have folded on the flop with a 12-out draw.
Hey, let me ask you this. Was the river a low card?
I did not say. So I don't know. Yeah, that would be good. I'm assuming it wasn't because the anger probably would have been a little higher.
Yeah, right. Wow.
There. But not that it changes anything, but yeah, but at least it would make you a little sicker, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the game itself is sick enough. You know, you don't need to have these types of hands just annihilate your stack like that. What a shame.
Well, you know, and Ken took it like a pro, too. He says, yeah, when he gets burned in a hand like that, he tries to take away the pain by imagining Aaron Rodgers putting on his championship belt on the podium after the Super Bowl. That cheers him right up, squeakly smiley face.
You guys, man. Freaking cheeseheads.
Well, you know, obviously probably not the best hand of the week ever, but I like the discussion on throwing away cards.
It's always
very the most difficult thing, I think, for people when they make when they switch to games where you have to discard. Particularly flop games like this.
Well, you know, and if people complain about the hand of the week, they can always just send in their hands. You come up with a good hand to send for us to work on. Make fun of us on the forum.
All right. Well, Ken, of course, is a previous swag winner, so he will not be getting anything else. But everybody else can get wonderful swag by emailing their hands of the week to podcast at anteupmagazine.com, including something great like a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net.
All right, well, I want to thank Scott for setting an Annie Up record today for mentioning the word contrived at least 4 times. That's definitely a record for the show. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Locke.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.